we have reduced what the council has said to the mundane can be holy, rather than we should make the mundane holy.
All right, welcome into another episode of The Deacon and the Doc. We're going to quickly get into this article by Dr. Larry Chapp. It was in the Ars Sunday Visitor. I'm sorry, I haven't even introduced my fellow co-host, Deacon Mike Beauvais. I just got right into things. Sorry, Deacon Mike. How you doing today?
I am doing fine. Dr. Thaddeus Romanski,
thanks.
The doc part of The Deacon and the Doc.
Right, right. And so we're had a lot to say. We have a lot to say about this article. Dr. Chapp writes frequently, blogs at Gaudium et Spes 22, the numeral 22. Theology professor. He's very involved in the Catholic worker movement. He's been on Bishop Barron's podcast a few times. One of his interest is defending the Second Vatican Council. So for our Sunday Visitor, he wrote an article called 60 Years After the Opening of the Second Vatican Council, Where Do We Stand? And we have a lot of thoughts about it. You had a really good reaction to it.
Yes, I thought he did a very nice job of explaining both where we might see some need for continuing improvement on the implementation of Vatican II, mm-hmm. but also that certain things in the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council, that there were some successes. There were things that, you know, we have now become so accustomed to that we don't realize that how much this has become part of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, so let's get into it. So he says it's a success and not a failure. And then the first example he gives is, or his first argument is, all councils have had controversy and turmoil.
Yes.
And he makes the point about Nicaea, that Nicaea was 100 years of...
Actually, 300 years.
Sorry, 300 years of further councils,
yes.
Lots of debate, Arianism being on the high hill, looking like it was winning.
Yes,
for
Maximus
a long time,
the Confessor lost his tongue in his right hand because he kept insisting that the church should follow what Nicaea.
Right, right. The post-conciliar chaos was caused by the exact same social forces that caused the problems after Nicaea, namely that there were many in the church who wanted the church to conform to the cultural and moral norms of the current culture, as well as the philosophical ideologies that animated that culture.
Yes, I mean,
that
mainly led by the emperor.
Right.
Who wanted the church to fit into his empire, mm-hmm. not his empire into the church.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you could kind of make a point of saying, you could say that the media complex, the global media complex, is kind of the emperor of... It's the ruling force of hearts and minds today, mm-hmm. and it wanted the church to fit into its ideology,
worldview.
Its worldview.
Yes,
wanted to shoehorn the church into that worldview.
Mm-hmm. Well, he also tackles the role of theologians, which, again, the point he makes is that, you know, you hear theologians complaining about Vatican II without realizing that if it wasn't for Vatican II, no one would be listening to theologians,
mm-hmm.
because theology was the purview of priests and bishops prior to Vatican II. And it was Vatican II which actually gave theologians a prominent role in forming the thought of the church. Not that they had any in actually implementing it, but certainly in forming
mm-hmm.
the thought.
So then he goes to successes of the council. I spoke earlier of the council being a success. You know, somebody could come back and say, okay, yes, everyone is familiar and kind of accepts, but people are really, they're just living with the fact that Mass is in the vernacular. That is true. It's widespread, but that doesn't mean that it's a good thing. I think that hypothetical mm-hmm. interlocutor could say, I think it's not good that the Mass is in the vernacular. I think it was a mistake that the Mass is in the vernacular. Just because something is widespread and familiar doesn't mean that it's a good thing. It's a good change.
Well, yes, but the comeback there would be one.
The council didn't call for that.
No, the council did call for parts of the Mass to be in the vernacular.
It didn't call for the
yes.
entire Mass
no,
being in the vernacular.
It did not. But again, just because it was... falsely implemented does not mean that the familiarity of the people today, that's why they're dismissive of the culture, is because it has been so successful in implementing these things, even though that wasn't the original intent of the culture, I mean, of the council. And so the point he's making is that we've become so familiar with the changes, we think we're done. Mm-hmm. And that's his whole point, is why should we still be paying attention to this? Because there are still certain things that have to be ironed out.
Now, he says, the fact remains that it was because of the council that we can all now pray the liturgy in our mother tongues instead of sitting back, as so many did before the council, and let the priest do his thing while we prayed a rosary. I mean, isn't that kind of a caricature of the
pre-conciliar mass? Certainly, that a lot, yes. But again, it is not false to say that there were instances where you had 30-minute masses.
I agree.
And, you know, and so, you know, part of the intent with the full participation of the congregation, active participation of the congregation, was so that wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that they would actually want to hear the word spoken by the priest rather than him going through there going, doing the entire Eucharistic prayer in a minute and a half.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that I heard Taylor Marshall say this, and he's a useful person to put on the other side of Larry Chapp. I know I heard him say, I'm paraphrasing. There's nothing wrong with somebody praying the rosary during the liturgy. They're drawing closer to Our Lady, and that's something that she called for us to pray the rosary, and praying the rosary is a good thing if that's drawing you into your deeper into your faith. And I might be not giving a full-fledged accounting of his point. What do we say to that?
We would say that the whole point of the Mass as a sacrifice is my offering a sacrifice of myself at that same time. If I am sitting there praying the rosary rather than being engaged in the offertory, am I really participating in sacrificing at the Mass? Because I'm focused on the rosary. I'm praying for whatever intentions I'm praying the rosary for. I'm not engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the whole point of the Mass. The Mass is a full engagement. Those gifts we bring up are representative of our gifts, of what I'm offering at the Mass.
But the rosary is helping me do that. The rosary is helping me.
I would argue that is more than likely not the case of the rosary.
What if I'm praying the sorrowful mysteries?
Again, it is a pious act, and it is well worth praising, but outside of the Mass. The Mass is a prayer already. You're substituting one prayer for another. And this, again, is Vatican II, that the highest prayer that the Church has to offer is the Mass.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rosary, by default, can't be the highest prayer. So if I'm praying the rosary, I'm not praying the Mass.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with you.
Yes.
I'm just trying to represent people who would
argue with this.
Yes. With this article.
In the article, all the things he's talking about, the successes of the culture as he sees, of the council as he sees them, the one thing that has really not been realized is the call to universal holiness.
And universal call to holiness.
Universal call to holiness. And partly because we have reduced what the council has said to the mundane can be holy rather than we should make the mundane holy.
How can somebody who is a believer in the council or supportive of the council say that the universal call to holiness was a success and that the council was a success when vocations have imploded, baptisms have declined, marriages have declined, mass attendance has declined, the pew poll, 70% of Catholics said that they don't believe in the real presence. It doesn't sound very successful to me,
well,
says the anonymous interlocutor.
Exactly. But again, you are attributing cause to something that can't be shown as the cause of any of these things. Just because they occurred doesn't mean that they were the result of the council.
Chronology is not causation.
Exactly.
You're going to go to that argument, Deacon Mike?
I'm
going
to go to that argument because can't show either that it wouldn't be worse without the council.
Well, that's an argument, too, that there people have Stephen Bullivant, who I interviewed him about his book, Mass Exodus. That is one of the points that he makes, that actually, when you compare the Catholic Church to the other mainline Protestant denominations, it's actually better
for the Catholic Church.
We're doing better.
Yes. And again, I wouldn't contribute that to the council necessarily either.
Singularly,
but rather to the fact that the church has not changed its teaching, which again is one of the misconstruing thoughts about the council, that it changed teaching of the church. It has not. One denomination that you can count on that has continued as a consistent moral guideline is the Catholic Church, and I believe that is part of the reason why the losses aren't as drastic as they could be. And the other, of course, being that we have the Eucharist.
Right, right. Cultural Catholicism is dead, and the forces within modern culture are all lined up against the message of the gospel. But so that's a great point. I think a traditionalist would come back and say, yes, that traditional form of Catholicism with there's no salvation outside of the church, there's not a dignitatis humanae understanding or explanation of religious freedom, the preconciliar liturgy, the devotional life that went along with that, all of that, that's what is really meat and potatoes. You can sink your teeth into it, different and countercultural from what the world is offering. This Vatican II Catholicism, it's too bland. It looks too much and feels too much like what's on offer from the world. There's too many parishes because of this liberal versus progressive split after the council. There's too many dioceses and bishops and parishes that have this kind of lukewarm, wishy-washy presentation of the faith. And that's why the council's not successful.
That is one a rather disingenuous argument, because the implementation of the council was certainly one, haphazard, and two, not true to the teaching of the council. The council itself, there was nothing in the teaching of the council that would make the liturgy in the least bit less reverent and less holy than it was prior to the council. It was just different. And if done with reverence and attention to the details of the Mass, it can be done exactly as reverently as pre-Vatican II.
Mm-hmm.
If we get fixated on how you said the words, you know, it's more important if you say them in Latin, I would argue that is not a valid judgment. I can say the Mass poorly in Latin and very well in the vernacular and have a much more reverent Mass. Now, I will give you that a lot of times, especially today, traditional Latin Masses are said with a greater degree of reverence because of the intent of making it more reverent, but that shouldn't be the intent of everybody. And so to just say that, you know, it'll be more reverent if we went back to the old Mass, I would say that's not a valid argument.
Okay. But what about, I mean, there was none of this synod on synodality business or synodal way in Germany going on before the Second Vatican Council.
Excuse me? Have you heard of the Protestant Reformation?
But they were consciously breaking away from the church. They weren't trying to transform the church from within.
Only because Luther couldn't get his way. Luther's intent was to change the Catholic Church, and which is the same thing we're going to see in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to get their way, and the only option they're going to have is breaking away from the church, whether they intentionally do so or whether the church excommunicates them.
Yeah.
But to say that, you know, this is a result of Vatican II, no, this is a result of our culture believing that we can change reality by what we want.
But I just read an article the other day that the I'm sorry, this is new information. It's not in this article.
Yeah, that's fine.
That the cardinal, who is the kind of the head honcho for the Synod on Synodality, he said that this synodal process is a great example. It's a perpetuation of the spirit of Vatican II. This is a Vatican official using that term, spirit of Vatican II, to basically justify the synodal path. Not the synodal path in Germany, but the synod on synodality, this concept of synodality.
Well, I'm not doubting that there
are... That doesn't seem good.
Well, there are just as many people who would have the opposing view working in the Vatican, although fewer and fewer at the moment. But the whole point of this is there is a trajectory of having more communication in the Catholic Church, both from the laity, and which was the whole point of the Synod on Synodality, is to listen to the voices of the Church. Mm-hmm. And I would say there's nothing wrong with this. But if you already have a goal in mind,
right,
then there's an issue.
Right.
And some of these people do have a goal in mind.
But this is kind of that idea of the accompaniment idea, right? We're just going to, you can't just keep accompanying and accompanying and accompanying somebody while they walk down the road to hell. At some point, you've got to intervene and say, no, you can't keep going along this way. And if you're going to go along this way, I have to, when we get to this stop, I'm going to have to get off the road with you. I can't accompany you anymore because you're not trying to come back onto the right path.
Well, again, this is...
we can't just listen and listen and listen and listen.
Right, but this is the conversation with Jesus and the woman at the well. It starts with a conversation, and it keeps going and going and going and going, hopefully to the point where she herself realizes what's going on, which, again, should be the whole point of accompaniment.
Exactly.
That we walk with them, hopefully to the point where we are presenting an alternative way of seeing the world. Mm-hmm. Now, if that person never realizes this, then accompaniment is a failure. Mm-hmm. And so accompaniment is only beneficial to the extent where we are doing a good enough job of presenting the truth, where people recognize this in the accompaniment and want to change. We cannot accompany them down that path forever.
No, I agree. I wholeheartedly agree with you about that.
But that does not negate the importance of beginning the process. Again, as with Jesus and the woman of the well, he could have just said, she's got five husbands, I'm not dealing with this. Mm-hmm. He found it worth the effort of conversion. And so this should be the direction the church takes.
Yeah.
That we engage sinners and walk with them as long as they're willing to consider that we're...
I just don't see enough of an attitude of... I think that's fine and good, but I think there should also be some presentation or some declaration, let's say declaration of, you know, this is what Catholic belief is, this is what Catholic teaching is. And if you don't want that, then you don't have to be a part of the Catholic Church. But you're not changing what we believe. We'll talk with you about it. We'll engage with you about it. We'll try to present it in different ways and with different bases for justification or explanation or reasoning. And we'll hear where you're coming from and your life experience and like that, you know. But we'll listen to you.
Yeah.
But this is the Catholic Church, and this is the teaching of the Church, and this is the truth. Ultimately, if you don't want to sign on for it, well, then you're gonna have to be outside of the Church.
So what you're telling me, you would prefer the approach of God's Rottweiler to the approach of accompaniment?
I think that just how we talk, I think that's more in the spirit of a Catholic both and, right?
Of course.
I think it's good to have accompaniment on one side of the coin and just a concrete, clear presentation of this is the faith, and we can go this far with you, but beyond that, we can go no farther.
I think, and I'm not disagreeing with you, I fully agree with what you're saying, but I think the whole point of the catechism is exactly that. that accompaniment is with the understanding that here's a catechism.
Right.
And nothing in here is going to change. We'll walk with you, but that isn't going to change what it says here.
Right.
What the church teaches is what the church teaches.
Right.
So if you want to, you know, campaign for gay marriages and, you know, we'll walk with you, but we're not ever going to go there. We can't. It's, you know, and this is the problem you're seeing in the church right now is there's too many people that say, well, if they're not going to change, shouldn't we just accommodate them? And there needs to be an authoritative voice that says, no, we cannot, which is exactly what the Pope has said.
And I think there would be a better in our media environment today, in our communications environment today, it would be helpful if the Holy Father is going to take the accompaniment side of the coin, if he had somebody like if Cardinal Mueller was still at the CDF and you had that other person making a vocal, living presentation of the catechism, not just leaving it kind of the catechism is this dusty tome that what we teach is over here. So, you know, we teach, but I'm going to keep walking with you and keep walking with you and keep. And I know, and I give the Holy Father credit for the letter on the negative responsum on blessing of same-sex unions that he signed. He made a point of signing it.
Yes.
And that's good.
Yes.
But there needs to be more of that so that there, I think it's just a little bit out of balance.
Given that the
organs of communication are going to go out of their way to misrepresent Catholic teaching.
I, again, agree with everything you've said, but it is not in my purview, and I don't have enough evidence to say that the approach the Holy Father is taking is not going to be successful. Because what I see is that he wants to be seen as being open to listening.
Yes.
You know, on everything. But he's willing to lay down the teachings of to profess the teachings of the church where he finds it necessary, as he did with the same-sex unions. You and I may say there's more points necessary, but I don't have the ability to say, no, he's wrong, because I don't know at what point he's going to do that.
Right.
And so, again, my job is not to question the Holy Father. My job is to say, perhaps this would be better, but that's my opinion.
Well, this has been a lively discussion about the article. I mean, we could keep going on this for a lot longer. I think it shows, or if nothing else, we've demonstrated that the council, its legacy, is a live issue. It's all wrapped up with how two Catholics, maybe an anonymous third Catholic that we're using here too, see the goings on in the church today as fallout, as legacy, as consequence of the council.
Yes, and that's, you know, the continuing conversation about Vatican II is, you know, which individual sees what.
But I do think there was more of a sense prior to this pontificate, prior to Pope Francis's pontificate, there was a more of a sense of kind of a settled or a coming to settled legacy and interpretation of the council. And his pontificate, for whatever reason, and maybe we can explore that on an episode in more depth, has reanimated this debate.
Well, I think in part it's because there's this great fear that Pope Francis has an interest in changing the Catholic Church. And this is seen as a continuation of the implementation of Vatican II. Although, again, from my personal perspective, I don't really believe that Pope Francis is as much interested in changing things as in invoking conversations about things to see where everyone stands.
And that's what we've tried to do today. We've tried to have a lively conversation to get you thinking, to get you talking. And so we appreciate you joining us on a little bit longer run of the Deacon of the Dock, but we'll be back next time.
We'll see if we can't find something else interesting to talk about, to sometimes disagree about, but always to be faithful about.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Deacon on the Dock podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please consider going to redsearadio.org/donate and supporting religious education for the domestic church.